Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio on location. I'm your host, Tom Azure, and we're at Michigan Technical Research Institute in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Some of our longer-term listeners may recall that we did one on wildfires, the smoke drift that was coming down from Canada with Laura Chavez and Nancy. And I'm with one of their colleagues here today, and it's Colin Brooks. Welcome to our program, Colin.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the interesting research that I get to do for a living.
This is going to be great. Let's pause for a moment of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you for the secrets and the laws that govern everything that we do, whether it be physics and the cells, the atoms, physics or such. Lord, some of the greatest scientists of all times were people who believed in you and forwarded the cause that brought us to the place that we are today. Be with us in our discussion, our research, learning, and to you be the glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Colin, you have a little bit of a British accent. Which side of the pond were you born at?
So I was born in Portsmouth, England, to a Scottish mother and an English father. And when I was 9 years old, they brought us to the United States. My dad worked in the nuclear power industry as a statistician. My mom was various times a homemaker, a school secretary, a medical secretary, and kept the family going with her two boys as we lived in various places around the world.
Around the world.
England, Belgium, Scotland, Maryland, and Georgia were the main places I grew up.
Amazing. So with this background, the stimulus of the international travel, how did you end up in the Michigan Tech Research Institute?
Well, in 2005, I was looking for a new job, and I'll talk about maybe briefly where I was before that. And they were hiring a Geographic Information Systems, or GIS.
GIS. Yeah. I got to tell this story, Colin. I worked at ITT Technical Institute, and they had a class in GIS. I had to learn what it was.
Yeah.
So, but I know what it is, but our listeners do not know necessarily what GIS is.
So think of GIS, again, Geographic Information Systems. Some people will say Geographic Information Science. Think of it as computer-based mapping technology. So essentially to be able to take the locations of all kinds of things locally, around the world, and understand the importance of its location. If you have a patch of wetlands and at the bottom of some hills, the water has probably had to drain down to there from further up the slope.
Right, gravity.
Water flows downhill, indeed. If you are worried about whether your bridge is in good condition, you're going to want to record the exact location of where maybe some potholes or spalls have formed, and you can see concrete rebar sticking out. So you're going to want to know the specific location within the bridge where the problems are. If you're trying to stop a new invasive aquatic plant from taking over your local lake or pond, and it starts showing up in places, you're going to want to record where those locations are
currently,
and try to understand if there are some reasons that it's showing up in particular places and where the plant might have come from as well.
Where it's migrated and probably also project where it goes.
Yep.
One of the things when I took the class and actually eventually taught the class, a lot of that has to do with nature and wildlife management, trees and location.
Yep.
And We explain that a little deeper. I'm trying to find the way to explain it, but their data point, you find a congregation of a particular animal or so on and so forth, and when you get the big picture, you can do some data crunching. You can make, it's also geographic, it's relative, it's yep. spatial.
Yeah, the connections between the features that you're studying may be important. Are they close to each other? Are they grow? If you're looking at plants, aquatic plants, which is one of the areas I work on, are they growing in particular depths or a particular water quality? So are there ways that you can predict where the plants might grow next, and also where, if you're trying to get rid of them, where understand where treatment might be most effective and what form of plant treatment might be the most effective.
So when you see these trends, you can draw analysis. This spatial data and information can be put out in multiple forms, in raw data, just numbers. It can be in graphs and pictures. Really, you can correct me or not, but we look at weather maps all the time. I don't know how much they use GIS.
That's a good example of what is a GIS analysis or a geospatial analysis. There they have, the meteorologists have integrated all kinds of data. They've integrated satellite data, weather balloon data, prediction models, and then brought that together. And the way that the information gets presented to people is in that map or that mapping interface if you log on to your favorite weather app. And we've all done, you know, we zoom in on where we live or where we're traveling to. You know, we know enough about mapping to go, oh, that's Lake Michigan or that's Lake Erie. So I'm going to be driving across the Mackinac Bridge. So I need to look at what the snow is doing in the Gaylord area.
Yeah, and it is. Yeah. When we're doing this recording, it is.
Yeah. I've heard people call it the science of place before.
Science of place.
Yeah. Okay. I think the ESRI or ESRI software company has used that phrase before. I've also called what I do essentially a location aware database. So I've got all these records of things, you know. This is where the pothole is in the bridge. This is where the cracks are on the airport runway. This is where these are the 50 locations that invasive Eurasian water milfoil has been found in lakes in Michigan. Because we can tie that to the location it's at, then we can do all other kinds of analysis. We can connect water quality data. We can get elevation data. We can for the infrastructure inspection, we can look at other infrastructure that's similar and see if we're seeing patterns and maybe bridges of a certain age. A lot of our bridges were built in the 1950s and 1960s. So these things are 50, 60, 70 years old, and they're reaching the end of our design life, their design life.
They were meant to be replaced at this point.
Yeah, and relatively speaking, in that era, as the interstates are being built and economies were expanding strongly, we put more money into building our infrastructure. Now we have this wonderful network of roads and bridges, but maintaining them in an operating condition can be expensive. So there's a principle called asset management, where you try to manage the asset so it's in as good condition as possible with the least cost. So instead, you may not fix the worst thing first. You may fix the things that are in moderate condition, whose condition is about to drop off quickly.
Okay, before it really gets
expensive. Yeah, and then you still have to fix the things that are bad, but you're trying to fix things before they get too expensive. And so a lot of my research, really the past 15 years, has been on how can we use these different sensing technologies to make the inspection and monitoring of our transportation infrastructure safer and more efficient and more easily repeatable.
You use the word remote sensoring. That has a big connection to this organization. Explain the history of it. If you want to go back, listeners, we talked a little bit about that with Laura Chavez when we were talking about the smoke drift from Canadian wildfires. But Colin, this is ground zero almost of it's a very special place.
Yeah, so we are the Michigan Tech Research Institute. We were founded in 2006, and we've been part of Michigan Tech University ever since we were founded in October of 2006. We're located in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There's some other university in the town as well.
Whatever. We're university.
We're this little outpost of Huskydom, of Michigan Tech, down here in southeast Michigan. And the university established us because they had long been interested in having some kind of research presence in southeastern Michigan. I mean, we're close to a major airport, so we can get to D.C. to talk to funding agencies easily. I've done a lot of work for state government agencies, and so I can get off to Lansing in an hour. Houghton is 540 miles away from here.
Wow.
It's as close to Ann Arbor as Washington, D.C. is.
Ah.
You draw a 10-hour driving radius approximately, 9 hours if you do it quickly. Don't do it too quickly.
Yeah.
And so we're well placed to represent the university. And I moved to Michigan in 2005. And I went to go work for a local nonprofit research firm, but they put our group, they put our 24-person group that was doing this remote sensing and GIS work up for sale, and Michigan Tech took that as an opportunity to establish their research presence. They brought on 24 people that were already doing research. We already had some of our own funding. Many of us were well-known in our fields. And so you've got an instant research presence. And we've grown from about a 24-person, $3 million research team to a 100-person, about $12 million research team in that intervening 20 years.
Wow. Tell about research. Many of our listeners, they hear the word, but they aren't sure what it is.
So, and we are a research institute. When you're doing research, you're trying to take the knowledge where you might have some subject matter expertise in, so something that you are, relatively speaking, maybe an expert in, and see if you can apply that knowledge, integrate new information, new cameras, new sensors, whatever they may be, new software tools, and then solve a problem that somebody has. And we're what's called a soft money research group. So the university doesn't pay us. We have to go out and win our own grants and contracts. And so we're all—
That's self-supporting.
We are self-supporting. And in fact, we've returned money to the university. So we do this research. I'm writing pretty much a grant every month.
Requesting money to do services, to deliver something to some governmental agency, largely either the federal or some state government.
Yeah, I'd say a majority of our research is funded through federal research. We do. I've done a fair amount of work for state agencies, particularly for Michigan Department of Transportation, has been a strong research partner for us. And we've done some work for local governments as well. We've partnered with companies. We partner with companies usually to go after a research grant or a research contract together. One of the things I enjoy most about this research job is the diversity of research projects that I get to work on.
Let's talk about it.
So my background, I went to school, I went off to college to be a forest ranger originally.
Okay.
I was going to go be out in the woods. I wanted to sit in a fire tower and look at the trees. I studied biology really as an undergrad at Lenora Ryan College in Hickory, North Carolina, a small private Lutheran school in the western part of North Carolina. Really enjoyed my time there. The small liberal arts school was the right place for me. And then I enjoyed the biology, particularly ecology, getting out in the field. I always knew I still continue to like getting out in the field. I was the kid that went to the local pond to find tadpoles to raise into froglets.
Uh-huh.
And would make my grandmother come with me, who was really not sure about it. We nearly always had a dog when I was growing up, so I had to take the dog on long walks, and we'd go out in the woods, and I'd go observe things. So I always, and then David Attenborough came along with his first
He's a world well-known biologist.
Yeah. Life on Earth was his show was called.
You can watch that on PBS, and it's a good show.
Yeah, yeah. So I was hooked at that point.
He has great graphics, too.
my mother used to call me one of David Attenborough's children.
Okay.
It was her expression. I don't know if she came up with that expression or not. And so I loved being out in the field and understanding the environment, the ecology of the world around me. So then for my master's degree, I went to Duke University, also in North Carolina, just a few hours east of Hickory, and switched from forestry to ecology because I was more interested in understanding the world around me than necessarily growing trees as a useful crop, but still, just growing the trees part. And so the summers in both college and grad grad school, because I went straight from one to the other, I used to work as an intern for the Nature Conservancy doing field inventories.
Okay.
And I worked two summers in coastal South Carolina near between Charleston and Savannah, and one summer in coastal Georgia just south of Savannah. And we would go out 4 or 5 days a week to go out and do plant inventories.
What do you got out there?
Huh? Yeah, particularly we were looking for rare plants or unusual plant communities, like wetland areas, because we've drained and destroyed a lot of our wetlands across the U.S.
And there, on the coastal area of the Carolinas, they had some low-lying areas, we've put cities on top of it, and you have limited what is our history, what's supposed to be here, huh?
Yeah, and so there's these remnants of...
isolated, not contiguous.
But still present. Yeah. I remember one time we were going down this bottomland swamp along the Cumbie River in South Carolina, and we found a rare plant called the greenfly orchid.
Okay.
And it was growing on the branch of a big tree, and it's an epiphytic plant, so it absorbs nutrients from the air and water around of the tree it's growing on, rather than putting roots down into the ground. And we were so excited to find that. And that record then got part of the biological database, so that people would know that this was a well-preserved enough bottomland swamp that a rare plant that had pretty much disappeared elsewhere could be found. And what we did, I mean, we had to do it with paper topo maps and estimate the length. We didn't have GPS.
It's all paper, no digital.
Yeah, this
no
is
computers,
like,
no laptops.
Yeah, we started, well, in fact, after my first summer of doing that, they sent me off to their headquarters, the Nature Conservancy headquarters for 2 weeks in Washington, D.C., and we took all the previous summer's records of where we'd found these plants and plant communities, and they introduced me to Landsat satellite imagery.
Uh-huh.
And this was the early 90s. I mean, Landsat still cost $3,000 a scene at the time. Nowadays, it's free. And I had all these location-specific records, and like, you're going to do GIS work, and you're going to become a remote sensing person.
And you said what?
And I was just a field intern that running around the swamps of South Carolina.
So you were the grunt.
So I was definitely, I was 19, 20, 21, and going out every summer there. But the computer-based mapping, which I quickly learned was called GIS, and that the satellite imagery analysis I was doing was called remote sensing, I loved it.
And you got into it.
Yeah.
You say, wow.
And we had these aerial photographs that they had printed of all our field sites. And so I found myself able to interpret where we were on these printed aerial photographs. This is, again, before we had easy access to GPS. And like, oh, I know where we are. That little line of swamp is right there, and that clump of what looks like pine trees instead of oak trees, because they look different colors on the map, that's right there. And so we were essentially that was the first inkling I had that understanding the locations of these features was something I could do for a career.
It just came natural to you.
Well, my mother said it was because I used to doodle maps all the time when I was a kid, which is true. I did used to do that. And so sometimes I feel like I've gotten paid for what I just did,
naturally.
What I just doodled in the margins.
All right. Let's take a break right now. We're with Colin Brooks. We're at the Michigan Tech Research Institute in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We've just got to know Colin, so we've introduced the term GIS, Graphic Information Systems, and we're going to see how that explodes, not only affects the natural resources, but will affect what you do every day. Some of the work that Collins does, the research that he does, not either currently affects the roads you drive in or will in the near future. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this break.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Collins Brooks. We're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Strong Tower Radio feature on location. We're so glad that you are with us today, listeners. Collins Brooks is on the cutting edge of many things that touch you every day, even if you don't know it. Collins, mentioned that you were out in the field with your bachelor's and your master's degree. You found out GIS, it matters where you're at and what's around you, and you looked at maps and you saw things, you made connections. Where did that take you next?
So my next job, I finished my master's degree, I went straight from undergrad to grad school, and I went to go work for the U.S. Forest Service at this
That's event. What you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I switched to ecology and went to go work for the Forest Service, and I was part of their quite new GIS, Geographic Information Systems program. And the Savannah River Forest Station is located on this place called the Savannah River Site, which is this 200,000-acre Department of Energy facility. And the Forest Service was brought in the 1950s to essentially manage the land that wasn't being used for the nuclear facilities that were there. So I came in, 40 years later and doing helping them implement electronic mapping, all the places where the different types of forest stands were, where the facilities were, you wanted to make sure you stayed away from them, where endangered species were, like bald eagles and red-cockaded woodpeckers. And one of my jobs was to write software tools that made those maps easier for people to access. And then GPS had come along, we had bought all these new GPS units, and so we were able to send people out in the field to record the location of things at relatively high accuracy.
So basically, listeners, as you think about it, along the highways, when they're laying out a building, you see people used to have transits and you had the sites and such, and that's become digital, but you also have the satellites, you all have GPS, you've got them on your phone, you triangle.
We all use Google Maps.
Use Google Maps, and you know exactly where you're at, and it's a powerful tool. Didn't mean to step on it, but when you think about, listeners, if you think about surveyor and you see with a transit, that tripod and somebody holding a stick, they now digitize that, and that's how you find out and map out the natural resources as well as roads.
For example, one of my first jobs was we didn't have a high accuracy map of where the railway was that came into the Savannah River site. And so they sent me walking along the railway with this new thing called a Trimble GPS unit. And so I walked the railway.
You find out that the map wasn't quite right? It didn't follow the pattern?
It had been good enough in the era before electronic mapping. But now we were trying to say, hey, this is a productive area for a pine forest plantation. This is a wetland area that we want to protect. And so you're trying to tell people where to go to do specific management activities on the landscape. And so the positional accuracy and the accuracy of features like roads and boundaries of properties start becoming even more important. And so again, I walked along that railway. I saw wild pigs and snakes. I won't tell you my story about the time I got bitten by a snake out doing field work back in South Carolina back in the day.
Few risks out there, huh?
So I worked for the Forest Service for 3 years. Met my future wife, and we both decided, she was living in Atlanta at the time, we both decided that we wanted to live somewhere else. So I took a job in Northern California running setting up a GIS lab for a Berkeley professor named Adina Marinlender, who is a conservation biologist, still continues to be very, very active in her field. I set up that GIS lab. I lived and worked on a University of California Davis Sheep Research Center for 9 years.
Okay.
Even though I was working on oak woodland conservation and salmon restoration GIS analysis. And both my kids were born in Northern California. They lived on the sheep ranch for a while. And then in 2005, there was a downturn in funding, so I was looking for a new job and moved initially to Michigan for the Altarum Institute. And then a year later, our division of Altarum was purchased by Michigan Tech. And when I came on board, there was this brand new project to try to help the Michigan Department of Transportation make better use of satellite imagery data.
And Why was that important to them?
This was an asset that they had become more aware of. There are now these commercial satellites. So Landsat was the original government one. Starting in the late 90s, there started to be commercial satellites. Iconos, I think, was one of the first. And so Landsat, the highest resolution of it at the time, was these 30 by 30 meter picture elements, pixels. And so they were quite long, 30 by 30 meters. A football field is 100 yards long, so it's about 100 meters long. So this is, you know, about a third of a football field is the smallest size.
It's the most accurate, the smallest unit you can get.
And suddenly with these commercial satellite vendors at the time, you could get 1 meter, you know, so 3 foot resolution.
That's a magnification of that.
Yeah,
100 or 1,000, whichever.
But. Yeah, yeah. There had been since the early 20th century aerial photography on a practical basis, but there an airplane had to go fly to a place and take pictures of it. Now these satellites were just circling the globe and could take pictures every few days of almost any place on Earth.
So you get time lapse.
So you get time. You could do change detection more easily. The satellites were often just collecting the data anyway, and so they were putting it into their archive. And
it just has to be analyzed.
Yeah. So you could task you could tell the satellite company, I want it this specific week, please, because maybe the plant you were looking for grows best that part of the summer, or a new road is being put in and you want to understand what the, you know, like how swampy is the area you might be putting a new road in.
You want to know it, well, you don't want to picture once a year a static thing. You wanted to know when you were in flood season and when you were at dry season.
Both with aerial photography and then with satellite imagery, they were also, many of these have been capable of collecting parts of the light spectrum that our eyes cannot see. So our eyes see from blue to red. So if you put it in nanometer terms, that's from roughly 400 nanometers to roughly about 700 nanometers. Well, that part of the electromagnetic spectrum continues both shorter and longer wavelengths. And in the near infrared, vegetation can look very different. So some of the aerial photography and pretty much all of these satellites were collecting data in the near infrared and made it easier to see what was going on with.
It just popped.
Yeah, and also you could use near infrared and land temperature data, because some of these satellites collected temperature data to do things like estimate soil moisture. So one of the demonstrations we did for.
So you didn't have to go down and take a soil sample and see how much moisture. You could interpolate it from
many places.
Data.
I mean, you still want the ground truth data. We still spend a lot of our time going out in the field and taking measurements, but that's in order to train our analysis algorithms so that we can apply what we've learned to other areas. So maybe you go to this one farm field and you measure, or this one wetland and you measure soil moisture, and then you find other areas that look very similar to it. in terms of temperature and near infrared reflectance, and you're able to say, oh, that's should be similar to this other place. And suddenly, instead of only being able to map one place, you're mapping 100 or 1,000 places. And so one of my favorite things about remote sensing.
So that's almost like your physical sample basically calibrates.
Exactly. That's an excellent way of putting it. We call it ground truth.
Okay.
You've got ground truth data, and then you reserve some of that data. Often it's about 20% of the data to then analyze the accuracy of your output product. So if I make a map of all the wet areas and farm fields, and this is something we did for MDOT for a bunch of locations, I was able to say that we got 19 of the 20 correct. So, okay. 95% accuracy.
And you didn't have to take 20 samples, you only had to take, maybe I got that wrong. But
well, in this case, we had been to visit 20 fields. And then because we were able to say that our algorithm on identifying wet areas and farm fields was working well, MDOT could trust us to find other locations beyond the initial 20 spots we went to. And so we demonstrated how they could use this to find what are called wetlands mitigation sites. So if MDOT does if it needs to widen a road or put in a new bridge, it may have to affect some wetland areas. There's no practical way around it. So what it has to do in that situation, it has to go buy some other property and either preserve or construct a wetland to make up for the area it's affecting.
To replace it.
Yeah. So we gave them an initial tool that they could go out and find other areas that might be suitable for wetlands mitigation sites.
Some and, that you might not see normally.
Yeah, you might not notice that, hey, this part of the field is wetter and floods more often because nobody's looking at it most of the time. except we've got these commercial satellites and the older and the complemented by the lower resolution but still very important free government satellites, because Landsat became free, which enabled a huge explosion in remote sensing applications. So that was the start of my career doing not only the environmental science ecology side, but starting to do transportation research as well. And I quickly glommed on to the idea that, hey, remote sensing is not being used as much as it should in the transportation world. I think I have something to contribute here. And so for a few years there, I did a little bit. And then I did another project where we were mapping forested wetland areas near a proposed highway bypass in Mississippi. Because we do work in we're based here in Southeast Michigan, but I've done work all the way from northern Alaska to the Texas-Mexico border. I mean, most of my work is in the Midwest and the Great Lakes states. I've done a bunch of work near Toronto. I've collected data in Maryland and Colorado and Nevada, and I enjoy going to see these places. So I did another project on the mapping the forested wetland areas so that the highway bypass could try to avoid the forested wetlands, working closely with my colleague Laura Chavez that you interviewed last time. And then I applied, I had this crazy idea that drones could help inspect road condition, because in the early 2010s, drones were just starting to become a more practical thing. So I put in that grant, the U.S. Department of Transportation, under what was called its Commercial Remote Sensing and Spatial Information Program, was putting some money into being able to use remote sensing technologies to help with transportation planning, environmental assessment. And I won a sizable grant as the lead, but first, my first big grant, I mean, I think I was 39 at the time.
So you're in the big leagues.
I'm further into my career. And the government has trusted me with $1 million to go see how drones can help assess road infrastructure. And because at the time we were trying to make sure that we didn't want to alarm anybody by flying along highways, the US DOT asked us to focus on rural unpaved roads, gravel roads,
okay,
for the most part. Because there you can fly a drone along a gravel road and not see anybody for ages. So we focused on gravel road assessment. I loved that project. We created a whole end-to-end system for taking the drone data and then automatically extracting out where the ruts, potholes, washboarding, and insufficient crown wear.
So you can do that on county dirt roads.
Yeah, and so we could do any gravel road. I worked closely with a gravel road expert up on campus named Dr. Tim Colling. To me, one of the secrets of my success has been, there's all kinds of things I don't know. You know, I could tell you about South Carolina swamplands. Nowadays, I can tell you about bridge concrete. But I wasn't a gravel road expert. And Michigan Tech has a lot of both environmental and also civil engineering experts. So there are professors up there. So I've made part of my explicit choice to work with these experts at Michigan Tech and elsewhere. But, you know, it's good to work with your fellow colleagues up on campus. The university likes that. And so I started working with the civil engineers professors there a lot. And then I started working. Then after that, we applied for a series of projects on how to use remote sensing to assess the bridge condition. Working particularly closely at the start of that process, before she retired, Dr. Tess Alborn, who is a world expert on concrete and how it degrades over time. So we came up with methods to use drones to find what are called spalls and delaminations.
Explain a spall. I should know, but I can't define it.
So most people would call a spall a pothole. They don't only occur on the deck of the bridge. It's where concrete has been lost, and so the concrete is missing now. It could happen with asphalt too, but it's most commonly associated with concrete. But if you've ever looked at the side of a bridge or underneath a bridge, you can see where pieces of concrete have fallen away too.
Right.
So any time when the concrete has been lost and there's missing concrete, that's a spall.
Especially if you see the iron rebar, steel rebar.
Yeah, you see the rebar, for example. For delaminations, that's actually a subsurface gap in the concrete where it has begun, because it's water and salt
minerals,
all that migrates into it. The concrete cracks and it can form these air gaps. And we knew from somebody else's study when they were using thermal videotape in the 1980s that you could detect where these gaps had started to occur based upon the temperature of the top of the concrete, because the gap underneath the concrete was beginning to warm up differently as the sun
cooler or hotter?
Warmer, because when that air gap forms, it warms the concrete above it more. The concrete above it warms more easily.
Okay. Transfer the heat.
It essentially because the air heats up more quickly, the concrete above it can heat up more quickly.
Yeah.
And we were some of the first people to show that you could identify these delaminations reliably using a thermal imaging system on board a drone. And did that work with Dr. Tess Alborn, with Dr. Thomas Uman, who was another expert, and published that. And my most frequently cited paper is about using using remote sensing for bridge condition assessment. My most cited work.
So how is that? How widespread has that seminal work that you did?
Most states now are using drones as part of their bridge inspection process. Michigan is, and across the country. I can't tell you directly how many people were necessarily inspired by but I know we were some of the earlier people to show, hey, you can see all the cracks, you can find the spalls, you can find the delaminations. And nowadays, if I go to a civil engineering conference, all state DOTs, some local ones, there are private drone firms that you can hire to do this for you if you don't have the money to bring that in-house to your state agency. It warms the cockles of my heart to believe, anyway, that the research I've done has made a difference to making bridge inspection easier.
Tell us the difference, the before and after, the previous method and the current method, the cost, time, what is the difference?
So one of the things we like to think we're doing is we're enabling the bridge inspectors to do more and more safely. So the traditional methods were you went out to the bridge and you had to visually look at every part of the bridge.
Underneath, on top.
You might have to get what's called a bucket truck or a cherry picker to, if it's a bigger bridge, to
reach
to
underneath.
Literally take a person underneath. Now you can image essentially the entire bridge, and then that expert, because these bridge inspectors are experts, can review the data. They can review the data not just when they're in the field, but also safely afterwards. They can essentially have a complete 3D model with photographs of the bridge, what's called a digital twin, is the expression that's used for that. And it's almost like being able to bring up the high-resolution inspection data anytime you feel like it.
And you can run that drone underneath the bridge.
Yep.
If it's over a body of water, you don't have to get a boat in order to...
Yep. Yeah, I've flown underneath and the side of bridges lots of times. And then we started integrating other technologies. We have what are called some autonomous surface vessels. So they look like little robotic boats.
Okay.
And you can program a path, or you can drive them with what looks like a game controller. And then we can use that to collect sonar data, so we understand the profile of the soil that's under the water near the bridge, and then we can help these transportation agencies understand where bridge scour might happen. Because the number one cause of catastrophic bridge collapses in the U.S. is scour, where you get a big storm event and it literally scours away the soil from the bridge foundation.
Then it drops or
the supporting piers of the bridge aren't as strongly
embedded
anymore. There's a famous tragedy happened in New York in 1987, where there was a giant storm in the Schoharie Creek area in upstate New York, and it scoured away all the soil around the bridge piers, and the bridge collapsed and 10 people died.
Mm.
And so the Federal Highway Administration, who has funded quite a bit of our research as well, in addition to MDOT, Michigan DOT, has given us several grants to be able to more rapidly collect the sort of data needed to assess a bridge both before, during, and after a big storm event has come through. And that's part of essentially their scour modeling and hazard response research programs.
So you can look over a period of time, you say, oh, it's like going to your dentist, and we're gonna have to go to break in a moment, but he says, I see a cavity starting to develop. We don't need to fill it yet.
But it's a worry that that's called scour holes. There's a worry the scour hole was here last year, it's gotten worse. Maybe a big storm has come through, it's now gotten 3 feet deeper. You know, maintenance needs to be done so we don't have a tragic incident.
Well, you know, our listeners may never go across the bridge again after hearing all this.
But they can know now that there are more technologies to help evaluate and be proactive on these problems. And so that's been exciting. We published some research on that a couple of times, both around 2014 and 2019. Funded by different parts of USDOT, and I can see people cite that work and go, hey, this seems to be helping.
All right. We're with Colin Brooks at the Michigan Technical Research Institute in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we'll be right back. We're going to talk about railroad safety. Stay tuned.
Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, surely I am coming quickly. We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. On Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Colin Brooks. You've opened our eyes. So remote sensing. I'm sure that some of the young people and young adults and other people, just their mind, they see drones. Their ears perk up, and you talk. Before, you were talking about satellites are in the sky and all that data. Now you're talking about drones that they've seen and touched. Don't only do bridge work. What other things do you do? What's exciting? What keeps you awake all day?
So an area of research I started getting into more recently, starting in 2019, was how to apply some of these drone and satellite technologies to railroad safety assessment. There, I've been working particularly closely with another civil engineering professor up at Michigan Tech named Dr. Pazi Lautala. Who is also an excellent interview.
You have to go up there.
Indeed.
I'm going to bring you with me.
All the way up to Houghton. I'm always happy to have an excuse to go to Houghton. Even this, I want to go see the Winter Carnival up there.
There you go. I do too. So we're going to have to make an appointment.
See our university students build those amazing snow sculptures and enjoy everything the Keweenaw has to offer.
That's right.
But Dr. Pazi Lautala runs our rail transportation program, been running that since 2007, graduating a lot of rail-focused civil engineers. And we've been talking for years about how's the sort of stuff that I do with satellite and drones maybe could help with assessing something about railways.
Talk about railway safety. I saw several websites about that. There's a concern. They've been trying to make a dent in it. They've made some progress, but there's way too many fatalities and issues around railway. And they're getting older.
Yeah, and the problem that Pazi and I, and another colleague of mine, Rick Dobson, who's worked closely with me since 2007, we ended up focusing on was the problem at what are called highway rail grade crossings.
Yeah.
So that's where you are driving up to a rail line and you have to cross over that rail line, and it's called, the short name for it is a grade crossing.
Okay.
And I'm sure we've all seen grade crossings that are steep.
There's one in our county, Wexford, that they have a sign that trucks should be careful because it's so high that it's lower on either side and you could get hung up.
Yep. Those are called low ground clearance problems or
grades.
And so Pazi knew that we could do really high resolution data. I mean, the highest resolution data that I've collected with our drones is sub-millimeter.
Wow.
Think about Landsat 30 years ago, at the beginning of my career, 30 by 30 meters. Now I'm doing work at like 0.8 millimeter resolution in some places. And so he knew we could collect not just high resolution images, but you can use a tool called photogrammetry to turn those images into 3D data. It's the same thing your brain does by having two eyeballs. It turns your two slightly different angled pictures that your eyes collect, and it turns it into a 3D view. That's what photogrammetry is, and we can take those stereo overlapping pictures and create what's called a digital elevation model out of it. And so we got a grant from the Federal Railroad Administration. We partnered with a small business startup, and we were able to show that we could collect very accurate, very quickly, this data that could assess not just whether or not it's called, another colloquial term is a humped crossing.
Okay.
You'll see all kinds of information about humped crossings. I'm holding a 3D print that we made here of some of the areas that we've surveyed before. This one's in Michigan. This one's in Minnesota.
And so it's higher in the middle. Of course,
yeah.
The rail, they put the rail grade high for a reason. They don't want it to be flooded,
right.
And so on and so forth. But when you run a car over the top, that's the problem because it's higher. It has that low clearance.
And cars are not typically a problem. But one of the reasons that Federal Railroad Administration put out this research is there was another tragic incident. This tragic incident was in, I believe it was Biloxi, Mississippi.
I know that place.
In 2017. And a tour bus full of elderly people that had gone out to one of the casinos out there. He was using this crossing. It had been recently maintained, and the crossing had been made steeper, and the bus got stuck on it.
Just hung up right in the middle.
Yeah, hung up in the middle, and unfortunately, a train came along. Trains cannot stop quickly. You know, they're huge, and so the train unfortunately hit the the tour bus, and four elderly people died. And so at this point, the FRA put out a call for new technologies. They had one where they put a what's called a LIDAR unit. It uses laser light to create 3D models. And they put that on a train, and then they engaged us and one other research group to see if we could do it with 3D drone data. And we showed that we could do it quickly and accurately. We put it into a web decision support tool, because that's another thing we do a lot of, developing decision support systems.
What is a web?
So this is in this case, it was a place where users could go to a spot where we had collected data with our drones, pull up the 3D data, and they could look at whether or not we did school buses, lowboy trailers, and just a regular car, and said, where would these vehicles get stuck on it based upon a standard length of the vehicle and a standard ground clearance? And then the other thing we did, because we had this really high resolution 3D data that was up to date, is we could also show problems with sight lines. So a vehicle, as there's recommendations published by a
group. So if you have a building that's too close there that you can't.
Or a bunch of vegetation that's grown up. A vehicle is supposed to be able to see a certain distance down the railway as it approaches a crossing, based upon how fast the trains are approaching and based upon whether it's what's called an active or a passive crossing. An active crossing is where a gate comes down. A passive crossing is where there's a stop sign. It used to be yield signs as well. And you need to see several hundred feet down the railway to see an approaching train. More further down, the faster the trains are allowed to be in that area. So we were able to rapidly calculate not just hump crossing status, but also sight line based upon what are called quadrants.
You showed up things that wasn't on the radar for people.
Yeah, and then we could share that information. Because one of the interesting things about rail grade crossings is there's joint responsibility for them. The railway is responsible for just the fairly narrow right-of-way that the rail line is on at a short distance each side of it. But then you get more than a few feet past the railway, then the local or state Department of Transportation is responsible. But to fix a humped crossing or a sight line area, it may be the rail line and the transportation agency having to work together to fix it. It's rarely going to be just one of them to solve the problem.
What about the local level of government too?
So I think one of the areas we did a bunch of areas for, let's see if I get the county right now. I think it's St. Louis County near Duluth, because they had crossings that were not needed anymore. And so we could help them assess which crossings were the worst for either humped crossing status or sightline problems, and they could prioritize those for closure so long as it didn't impact the larger traveling public. And so our understanding is they used that data to help evaluate the crossings, the crossings near Duluth. And again, when I get really, the thing that excites me most about my job is when some method I've developed, some technology I've assessed, some new algorithm I've led the development of or worked with partners on, actually starts getting used by people.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was in the automotive industry and I brought a taillight to market. And when I saw that taillight, it was emblazoned in my mind because I worked on it 6 months. I said, that's my taillight. That's my Royal Road Crossing or whatever.
I went back to my school, and I went back to school in my 40s, lifelong learning, and got a PhD in aquatic biology.
Wow.
And I focused on using drones to map invasive aquatic plants. And now drones for mapping where aquatic plants are and studying the effectiveness of different treatment methods is becoming more common.
It's a tool.
Yeah, it's a tool.
Preferred tool.
Yeah, it's a tool. It's much more practical.
You've just, as Laura brought it out in our last interview, and then I went out, I was along Lake St. Clair, and you saw the invasive species, and I identified them, but you could not see Some people, she said that some people lived there and didn't know there was a lake on the other side.
Yeah, the Phragmites common reed was so tall that you couldn't see the lake anymore.
And they're 10 plus feet high.
Yeah, I think 15 feet's the highest we've measured.
I didn't want to exaggerate. So.
And we've seen with some of these aquatic plants that we've used our drones for, we were doing, we were flying over a lake in Ohio with permission, and we saw acres and acres of this invasive aquatic plant called hydrilla. And yes, you can kayak or canoe a boat out there, but you can't see everything. And you can't get everywhere
perspective
easily.
I could even think about it being used for mangroves.
I was just visiting for a friend and colleague's wedding in India last month. And while I was there, I did a kayak tour of mangroves. And I was taking all these pictures because I'd love to do a project on mangrove mapping with satellites and drones, if that...
Well, we're on the same page. Well, Collins, our time is just getting away. What do you want to leave our listeners with at this time?
So, hey, I was this little kid that liked mucking around in swamps and looking at frogs and studying how a creek changed over time, because I was down at this local creek when I lived in Maryland, pretty much every day. And that gave me this love of this natural world. And I have this desire to try to pass on some of that beautiful world to the next generation so that they can appreciate it too. You were talking about the concept of stewardship earlier.
Yes.
That we can be good stewards of this environment that we've been fortunate enough to inherit, so that future generations can enjoy it and the plants and animals that live in it have the chance to exist in the future. And, my bridge and railroad research might not feel like it has a huge amount to do with that, but, having two fairly different areas in my career has helped me stay funded. And so...
Stability.
So we have a lot of GIS interns that come through here. Encourage people, if they've got GIS remote sensing experience, to apply for internships here. You can visit our MTR, just Google Michigan Tech Research Institute. We have an internship page. But if you like getting out in the field, if you like understanding the environment and why it's working the way it does, whether it's studying concrete degradation or whether it's studying rare plant mapping, a GIS remote sensing career, you're probably going to get the opportunity not just to sit in front of a computer, which is fun, but to go out in the field and understand the places. And so, go out and get to study that civil engineering, go out and get that biology degree, but make remote sensing and GIS part of your education. And I don't think you're going to regret it. It has lots of jobs in the area, and it's going to give you a leg up in that career of yours.
Well, Colin, thank you for taking part of your time as the second visit here to Michigan Tech Research Institute. I have a feeling that there's more to be explored here at Michigan Tech Research.
There is. Again, our webpage is mtu.edu/mtri. We have examples of some of our projects on there. Nearly all the principal investigators here have papers we've published. I just had a new one come out about mapping different road surface types using aerial photography. I'm very excited this article came out.
You heard it here first. Well, listeners, for Strong Tower Radio On Location, I'm Tom Majeure. Until next time, God bless. Bye now.